And welcome to the Dice Are Screaming podcast.
Woo!
Oh, hey, it's a whoop. It's a whoop.
Yeah, the dice are whooping.
Expect no less. Oh, expect no less from? I'm going to stumble in this one.
The little gaming podcast that does, in fact, have both hands and a map.
Oh, wow. I'm not sure where to go with that one, but I feel
you found us.
Yeah, I feel like I found it. All right. Yeah, you beat me to it. Okay, so hey, welcome, folks. I'm Randy.
I'm Mike.
Yeah, and he's in good form today. So hey, today we're going to be talking about our favorite class. Let's talk about druids.
Hey, man, I need my punching bag. Okay. Oh, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I promised that I would be on my best behavior for this episode.
Because, oh, this is all you, man.
Yeah, we're getting on to part of the, you know, root history of, you know, druids and why did they become relevant enough to be included in the game. So, yeah, right.
we can all agree that warriors, barbarians, even paladins, templars, they all have their antecedents in history and myth and popular fiction. I mean, we can look at that, but why are druids here, and more importantly, as possibly one of the least played classes, although, I mean, people could take issue with that.
Oh, honestly, I mean, it's partly because the popular mythos, like there's strata to it, okay? Right. Like this is going in geological terms as you dig through the layers. And at the surface level, like, you know, just a little scrape of the soil gets you the Arthurian mythos and the classical gods of the, you know, Greeks and Romans. Like these are just really low bar. Okay. Mm-hmm. They're very accessible and very popular, not dissing them. Okay. I'm not dissing them at all. But you got to take another layer of topsoil off and start getting down to some deeper ground before you run into the Northern European paganism and Southern European paganism, like anywhere from the Mediterranean all the way up to the, you know, Breton Isles. All of these areas had some contact with what we now think of as Druidism proper.
Or Celtic. Yeah, the Celtic peoples. The Gauls, the Celts.
Yeah. And
were synonymous one another.
You'll notice that like that paganism, you know, kept getting pushed back until it's thought of as a far Northern European thing. But that was like the holdout areas that, you know, conversion came later or was less popular for a longer period of time. But the epic characters that anybody who has done some modest study, like obviously guys like Gary Gygax or Dave Arneson, you know, if they'd done their college reading, which boy did they ever.
Yeah, you get Julius Caesar's notes on his encounters with the Britons and their priesthood, the Druids.
Yeah.
And some of it may have been Roman propaganda to show that, like, hey, we got to civilize these wild people.
Yeah.
But surprisingly, even in Caesar's notes, there's an in-depth philosophy here. Now, of course, reincarnation plays a big part in Celtic and Druidic myth. It's a central figure of their belief system. To have this kind of advanced philosophy that not only is deep, but in depth of outside of its core belief system in a primitive society was very shocking to many Romans at the time. They're like, how did you come up with this in-depth philosophy when you're still just trying to master some of the precepts of the Iron Age?
Yeah. Artistically, Northern Europe had some amazing things going on. Okay. Including like fine metalwork.
Well, yeah, the Celts were renowned for their bronze craft as well as their early steel making.
And like all the way up to the, like before the era of the Vikings proper, the Norse and other Scandinavian areas had some amazing gold work. Like their artistic creativity was amazing. But if you look at the funerary rites that they all undertook, you begin to notice that there's some weird similarities. Like, even though many of these cultures had different names, different deities per se, they had all brushed up against Druidism. And so many of the like mythopoetic heroes that survived in, you know, fragments, a lot of the things they're undertaking are more like, you know, less magic per se, and the secrets of an initiated druid.
Right. Well, the Ogma.
Yeah.
Am I pronouncing that right?
The Ogma.
Ogma. Okay. The Ogma is much like the Norse runes. It's very serious business. This is not just lightly undertaken. The understanding of each one of these is almost a sacred or magical aspect. The writing itself,
which speaks to its importance.
Right.
The idea of being able to carry it on in a in a society that did not have a wide degree of literacy. The Ogma, honestly, I feel like the ancient world had the habit of making something mystical and making something important because if you knew that it was important and you knew what chuckleheads people tended to be, you really had to drive it home. I mean, you got to sell it. You got to sell it like a showman. You know, you got to P.T. Barnum this stuff, because the average curve of humanity drifts towards, TLDR, dude. And then you're like back in a mud puddle.
That's our podcast.
Trying to figure out. You're back in a mud puddle trying to figure out how to rub two sticks together to stay warm. And knowledge is the prevention of that. It's why it was fused with holiness, because this way you can get people to be serious about it and pass it on. Like, no, seriously, you're going to need to know how to do some math eventually. I know you don't think it's important right now. Trust me, if you want to build anything that lasts past one season, this is the way. But Druidism was a vehicle for that expression of important knowledge, albeit heavily mysticized.
And it got mythologized.
And law.
Yeah, in post-Roman Britain, Caesar was mightily impressed with that they had such a deep philosophy that, you know, even the Greeks and those before the Greeks worked laboriously to define the idea of reincarnation. It had been proposed many ways, and it obviously wasn't a new thing to Caesar, but it was something that kind of rattled him that, like, these far savage primitives, just basic far-ranging savage primitives, are capable of this level of metalcraft, as well as their ideals of how to keep a nation before nations. And you could say, like, hey, this is a whole of a nation. The idea of the Arthurian myth linked with the idea that the land is the king is the land. That is very druidical right on the onset, right?
Oh, there. Boy, yeah. That, like the concept of an interdependent relationship with the place in which you exist is a recurring theme that, I almost feel like that's one we could bring back. Less keen on the, like, kill people and throw them in a bog
or hail the king on fire. Or have a monarchy. Yeah. The monarchism was the way to unite all the people together. A king unites the land. And also for them, it meant spiritually. So that's where a lot of the ties, I think, started with the mystery of the Druids. Now,
also, they made a lovely check on things because, like, as the king, you really did not want to tick off the people who had been intrinsic to your being, to your ascendancy. If you suddenly become a bad king who is not only harming the land, but the people, and the Druids don't want you there anymore, your time was numbered. So, you know.
Yeah, they withheld the support from you. Your
little checks and balances.
But Anyway, rather than going through the whole historical camp, let's talk about some of them. Obviously, Stonehenge is tied to the Druids, and that's a timekeeping event, which gives them the power of seeming to control or influence nature. To a lot of folks who don't understand the importance of seasonal changes and being able to predict when rains will come and secede, this is very important to an agricultural-based society.
And let's face it, the experience of humanity on average has been that, there are historical precise bottlenecks in the human genome, like moments where, wow, like on a few occasions, the entirety of humanity was down to, just a few thousands or tens of thousands of beings. Yeah. And that happened more than once throughout history. Mm-hmm. So obviously not in a very long time, but food scarcity and the question of, will there be enough of us left for viability? I think that still haunts us even to this day. That, like, that's a part of our consciousness, the awareness that, I'm thinking we should get out in front on this one. So food security has driven us for millennia. And if you had a religious order that aided you in food security, how beloved would they be? I mean, how revered? Like, if they did something useful other than, like, imagine a class of people who studied math and astronomy and were able to tell you with reasonable accuracy when it would be safe to plant without losing everything that you had carefully hoarded away for the next planting season. If they did something useful like that instead of building theme parks or buying private jets, like, it would be really hard to have contempt for the people that helped you stay alive. And be
more to the point, I think we're getting a little off track here. Let's get back onto where this applies.
But that's why they're revered.
Right.
And thus their reputation descends down.
Yeah, everybody has a theory about Stonehenge. And, everyone is basically like, we're guessing. But I think, let's not overthink it. It probably was a timekeeping device as well as an assemblage area for important events and annual ceremonies. So that probably had a lot to do with it. But nonetheless, we associate the Druids when in gaming, like you said, with Guy Gaxarnes and a lot of other people who introduced. I'm not 100% sure who really put into paper on the Druid class. Dennis Astaire, a couple of others have kind of been mentioned, but that's a good one to ask Tim Cass. Who really came up with the Druids? Because he ended up playing his character, Jero Ashdaff from Hamlet. That's his character.
Oh, man.
So you definitely know the weird guy out there smoking doobers in the woods with his bear. That was him. So let's talk about that. Why is the Druid also associated?
Out in the woods, up to no good. I want to make friends with the badger. Little dead milkman.
Sure.
Right. We love you guys.
But he's out there with a bear. But anyway, what is the association with Druids and animal companions? Where does that really come from? Nature priests?
Yeah, I have always assumed that it had more to do with finding a way to have these priests of nature have a useful trait, like their own version of a familiar. That more historically, the use of birds as spies or squirrels, knowing what the animals are saying, having lived among them sufficiently to understand their behavior and to interpret from that, like, I know when an army marches, I know if a group of bandits is lurking in the woods. The silence or noises of the animals, the sudden flight of a flock of birds that has no other reason to leave that area.
Or the calls of blue jays
at
your approach when you're walking.
And being able to read that implies that they have a relationship that is beyond the comprehension of most people with the creatures in their surroundings. I don't know why they D&D broke it down to something simpler beyond speak with animals. You know, to having a companion, other than perhaps just that they know players love to have companion animals. Like, you know, the first thing anybody does is like, I buy a warthog.
Sure.
Or I've got a cool horse that is smart enough to know one trick. Just, or if he's really smart, he's got three or four tricks, and like you name him Trigger.
Okay, you can count.
Yeah.
However, but we, yeah, we look at that. That comes from alleged also abilities of them to command beasts and also know their language by being so primarily connected to the source. That's another way of looking at it, I guess. The other part is the wild shape. Now, throughout the years, druids have had a different retcons or, you know, redos. The wild shape used to come at 7th level in the early versions. Like, you didn't start out with a wild shape talent at all. Like, 7th level, then you were initiated into the greater mysteries, and now you could assume animal forms.
And not to conflate too much, this is, you know, some historical mythological guessing.
Right.
But when you have these people who spend a great deal of time studying the behavior of animals, so much so that they seem to be able to interpret signs and, you know, portents just by observing the animals themselves, by knowing their surroundings perfectly and appearing to be in total harmony with them. Another mythological trick to expand your own power would be to imply to people that the birds are watching you on my behalf, but you also can't be entirely sure that I'm not one of them some of the time.
Yeah, a lot of gods, so specifically trickster gods, could assume animal form.
Bingo.
Loki, Odin's ravens often communicated to him, as well as Ratatosk, the squirrel that ran up and down the world tree, carried messages to the gods from the lower realms or other worlds.
Yeah. Now, pay close attention there, because that's the same area of paganism, the same regional like zone, you know, that these myths of druidic abilities emerged out of.
Yeah, and also, so, like Caesar noticed that druids were forbidden from touching swords.
Yeah.
They had a that's why their weapon use, just like clerics were forbidden from shedding blood, and thus why they were limited to blunt weapons, primarily.
Yeah, the druid is not a warrior, and is not intended to be a warrior. Like, this is, you know, like, the beyond what is absolutely essential for their own immediate survival, you know, like the shedding of blood is technically a sacred rite level event. It is not something that they're supposed to be running around willy-nilly just hacking people up.
So
their job is to, you know, be shepherds and guides.
The scimitar is likely a idea of the sickle, which is a harvesting tool, but it can also be used to slit throats. And that's what he noted. So that's why they get the scimitar, the spear, because, well, it's essentially just a sharp stick.
Well, and the staff is pretty obvious.
Yeah, staff, club, sling. And they were also forbidden from wearing metal armor. Now, that's not anything, I think, really
historical, or
mythological. It's just like, yeah.
It's more like, what was the point? If your person is sacred and you're not supposed to be, like, tearing people up on the battlefield anyway. Like, if you're not supposed to be wielding a sword, you also don't really need shields and armor and all of that. You know, that it less of a holy writ rule and more of a situational lack of need.
And I think also, like, them wearing leather and only using wooden shields gave them the bonus of saving throw versus fire and lightning. That was, I think, maybe just tossed in there as a nod, like, here's a game balance sort of thing. Like, okay, for this, you get, for being restricted in your armor use, rather than a cleric who can just throw on any type of armor, this type of devoted priesthood only has a certain amount of...
Yeah, we got to fluff this up with a few perks, because...
Yeah, like, we got to... If we're just restricting to leather armor and a wooden shield, then that's not going to really fly well. So, yeah, you get a +2 saving throws versus fire and lightning spells or effects.
Oh, but that spell list, though.
Oh, yeah, and there's
the earlier access is really nice.
Yeah, the Fairy Fire, Leader of the Good Berry, as well as a couple of the Produce Flame and, what was the other one? A shillelagh, yes. The first level, classic. Oh, me shillelagh, and just take a club and just whoop the living snot out of somebody with it. Made the druid, and bark skin also.
Which is less a matter of druidism per se, and more of a nod to the, you know, like, there was a marvelous Irish tradition of the shillelagh that, like, came after. But it survived and prospered in Ireland, the making of a fighting walking stick, because the first thing, you know, the British did would be to, like, take away everything that you could possibly fight with. I can't let them have any sharp things. And so you were helpless on the roads. Like, oh, you wouldn't deprive an old man of his walking stick, would you? And thus the shillelagh, which became an, like, literally fighting with it became an art form undertaken under the table, so to speak. But I love that they included that, like, the predecessor of the shillelagh also as a druidic tool. Like, here, make, you know, you take a generic club and bam, you have just given yourself a magic weapon, even at low level.
Let's talk about the, real quickly here, about the holy symbol of the druid, which was different types of mistletoe, oak, holly.
Yeah.
And that you had to harvest it under certain conditions. So right away you had kind of a character that, you know, greater and lesser mistletoe was harvested and just explained to you. Greater mistletoe was something you had to get yourself.
Yeah, you've got to go to a grove. You have to find it.
During a holy day.
And then, at the appointed hour, you must cut it yourself.
Which meant you had to quest, but it gave you 25% efficiency to the damage and durations of spells. It was better.
Which was a unique aspect of all druidic characters. It was not until much later in the game that things like magic spells were influenced positively or negatively by, like, extend spell or enhance spell or any of that. The druid had that mechanic depending on what they were carrying as their holy symbol.
Yeah, it could be oak.
They could even be penalized, like, if they had to use a cheap substitute. Like,
right.
Oh, man, I got the bargain basement bin oak leaves. I could just barely get a spell off, but...
Yeah, everybody gets a +2 to the saves. But, so, yeah, you're...
It is what it is. It's what I got.
But that also relates to their ties to nature and also to the way mistletoe was looked at, because mistletoe is the bloodshed on the leaves and the berries. And, yeah, mistletoe is very garish. Yeah, we now... And, but also, kissing under the mistletoe was a fertility symbol.
Yeah,
it's a part of a rite. So there's that. So it's very
those little tidbits are still around even in popular culture today. So it gives you something of a window into, like, if something is still lurking around here from the freaking Dark Ages and from before, how important must it have been in its time? A little haunting there,
but. As we cover some of the historical stuff and we start to now get into more of the game specifics, just their spell list alone of the, like, the Chariot of Sestair, you know, the fiery chariot pulled by fiery horses. I mean, wow. And of course, who can forget the greatest hits of the druid spell list? Creeping Doom. Before Metallica put it in, Creeping Doom. Yeah, a lot of druids, like, had an offensive firepower that clerics somewhat lacked, especially throughout the rest, because...
Oh, you had to get up there in level before it really kicked
like in. Like, okay. Flame Strike, Blade Barrier came in.
But they also had a level cap as
the druid
class was created. Like, there's just no higher you go than this. You know, once you're the Archdruid, there is no further. You know, you retire...
Or the Great Druid.
Yeah, the Great Druid, sorry.
Yeah, you turn into, you know, ostensibly you move on to the Hierophant and then go on a wandering of the plains. But yeah, all the retirement area of the druid was only at 14th level, and then it was Hierophant from then on. So you could keep playing, so to speak. But anyway, the druid became a very rich class, and then with the other additions that come in, they began to extrapolate more on the wild shape. Players were really responded to that, as well as certain other character classes that coincide with the druid, like the barbarian to some extent, and the ranger who had druid spells.
Oh, very much. It seemed as though, it broke down along lines of like the woodsy characters all have a little connection to Druidism and nature. Mm-hmm. You know, the ones who spend the most time outside. But I did want to, during this session, touch on the one deficit of the Druid, you know, like the thing that is hung over them since the beginning. The only thing about them that was, I think, more crippling than the armor penalty, like the not being able to wear full gear and use heavy weapons, more crippling was that so much of their power was based on being outdoors.
Yeah.
Only a few of like their better traits were viable in dungeons or like indoors or in cities. There are just some things that, while they're very powerful anywhere else, they are absolutely no use whatsoever under
circumstances. Yeah, they're less by that because their application of running of pure water and weather conditions, all that, isn't as important in the underground. But, however, in the Underdark, you find a new path where you have them communicating and working with plants and the fungi and mushrooms to identify the safe ones to eat. Oh boy, those guys who had to do that early work. Pity those guys. Nope, this one's bad. How do you know? I'm dying.
Who ate it first?
Yeah.
That is actually a history question right there. It's like, who ate the first this, that, or the other thing?
I'm gonna test it out.
And yeah.
Goes
hazardous
back.
You really do want somebody who can tell you like no, don't eat that one. That
yeah, and their pass without trace power is not that as important in a stone setting like a dungeon corridor or anything like that, but right, you know,
still
like,
potentially useful, but
that was
not
a big drawback. Like call lightning could not be used underground.
Yeah,
and that was one of their signature attack spells of fourth level. You know, it's like, yeah, I'm gonna call lightning down. It takes you a while, but boy, I'm going to devastate you when this ritual's done.
Yeah, and the timing on it was a tricky one. You know, that, like, yeah, boy, I hope this combat goes on this long. Or, you know, like, can we possibly get me to an area, like, you know, we need to be near, but not too near that we wind up being seen so that I can start the procedure on this spell and then...
Right, if you don't have summon weather, it takes a while. If you had summon weather and you could summon a thunderstorm...
Bingo.
Now you're cooking with gas. But
yeah, the mystical control over weather is, you know, like more like a game reinterpretation of the ability to know what's coming, which, you know, goes back to that predictive power, that divinatory capability that was ascribed to druidic priests.
Yeah, and divination was a big part of it too. But also there was some bleed over in second edition, when they had not only druids presented as a specialty cleric example, but also several clerics who worshiped the same gods of nature that they did, like Obadhai, Maliki, and all the others. So that also probably got cluttered up, but I see that a lot more is now that where the druid is firmly their own character class. It is not, it is a divine spellcaster in the way that a cleric is, but they're completely different from the cleric. Now the way they cast the new spells, but
very much so.
We've given some druid love, I think, in this episode.
Yeah, I mean, did you hear me back? You know, just bagging on them? No, I behaved myself.
I mean, we've got
there's a lot of important history there. I'm just saying that, like, I give them a little side eye because everybody gives the horny bard so much crap. Horny bard, don't screw anything. We're playing a fantasy game with a world rich in half human, half animal creatures, and you're not looking off to the side. You're not giving the side eye to the wild shaper. Really? Yeah. I'm just saying, you know, get a good priest, do some divinations, get some paternity on that. Because I'm just saying it ain't all the bard's fault.
All right. Well, yep. Bard. You get all the victimization, but really, it's druid with his badger Steve and his beard bees.
Yes. All right. And his beard bees. All right, sir. We're wrapping it up.
Yeah.
You guys take care.
Right on. And so we'll see you next time. Until then,
the dice
always roll in your favor.
We're out.
See ya.